Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a very exciting founder that is joining us. You know, we are definitely about to experience an incredible conversation with a founder that has done it multiple times. He sold his companies to the likes of IBM, you know, done the whole thing of going public, raised all the money that you can think of, and gone through the cycles. So, you know, now he's on a rocket ship. We're going to be talking about it too, how he's disrupting this outdated, you know, kind of like a industry that is massive and what they're doing about it. And again, you know, super incredible, you know, founder and conversation that we have. So brace yourself for a super unbelievable episode. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Zvi Schreiber. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
So give us a walk through memory lane, because you were born in London, spent a bunch of time in Jerusalem, you know, there in Israel, and now in Barcelona. So I guess you're a citizen of the world.
Yeah, I'm still in Jerusalem, but also splitting time in Barcelona, where we have our biggest office. So yeah, briefly, I started my career as a software engineer. And while I was doing that, I did a PhD in computer science, so technical background. I still get in, you know, get involved in the technical side when I can. But for many years, I've been an entrepreneur. I've had acquisitions, successful acquisitions, fire sales, a mixture of everything. But now already for 12 years, I'm a founder and CEO of Freightos. And you can think of us like Booking.com or Expedia for international freight. So we're trying to digitize a very big, very important old industry and bring it into the 21st century.
And we're going to get into that in detail. But, you know, before that, we got to get to know you, Zvi. So how do you get into math? So obviously you went to study at Cambridge and you got all types of shiny degrees, you know, around mathematics. But out of all things, mathematics. Why mathematics?
I just seem to have a natural skill at it, and I love it.
Well, that's good, because that got you into, I guess, becoming a software engineer. So how was that journey from being a software engineer to all of a sudden taking ownership of your own future and becoming an entrepreneur?
You know, I think in many cases, certainly for me, that it was just sort of a natural progression. I worked for a very good software company in London, and I sort of saw how they did things. And at some point, I thought, I want to try to do this myself. And so, you know, someone once defined an entrepreneur as someone who's unemployable. You know, I sort of couldn't hold down a job for long. I was itching to try it for myself.
That's amazing. So tell us about what happened there, you know, because it was during the 2000s, you know, with all the craziness kicking into with the bubble, you know, and so forth. So how was that like?
Well, that certainly was crazy for your younger listeners who weren't around through that. I mean, in 1999 and the beginning of 2000, there was a bubble like we haven't seen since in tech. It was, the internet was very new and stocks went completely berserk. I mean, there were startups, you know, valued at tens of billions of dollars without any profit and barely any revenue. So it was a very extreme bubble. Actually, for that year, I had a company called Tradium at the time, also doing sort of B2B platforms. And I moved, I raised money in Israel and then moved to the Bay Area at that time. So I was actually in the San Francisco Bay Area at the peak of the craziness. And it really was a wild time. And I was able to sell my startup to a startup really called VerticalNet, which was public with a $10 billion valuation at the time. And I sold it in March of 2000. Within days of that sale, the market crashed hard. And the shares that we received on paper, it was a really good exit, but the shares crashed by, well, 10% and 20%. And before long, they were down 99-point-something%. So it was quite a roller coaster.
So what did you learn there when it comes to cycles?
I learned that things that don't look real aren't real. And I have to say, I went into this deal with my eyes open and advised people. I told my team, look, you know, on paper, we're selling for $500 million, but this paper is very hyped. And so I went in, fortunately, with my eyes somewhat open that this may not be a sustainable thing. And I don't, none of us knew how quickly and how dramatically it would crash, but we were certainly well aware that things were likely to crash because it didn't make any sense. But, you know, it just the lesson is the obvious one. If a valuation doesn't make sense, if a startup, which isn't doing particularly well, is valued at $10 billion, then that's probably not going to last. And I've seen that with many other hypes of shares, of technologies. You know, I think to some extent blockchain went through a similar thing. When things get overhyped, then there's a correction, as you'd expect.
So then in your case, you know, you ended up, moving on to the next chapter. And once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. And the next one also had quite the outcome. So how was that journey with the next company?
Yeah, I mean, so it was tough in a way, because what happened after 2000, in the bubble, everyone was spending money on IT like there's no tomorrow. So companies were really investing. And then when the bubble burst, then, you know, and I started a company called Unicorn. This was before Unicorn had the connotation that it has today. And we were selling data management to big banks and big insurance companies. And it was a tough time because everyone was slashing their IT budgets. Everyone was nervous to buy from startups because so many startups went bust in 2000. So big enterprises became much more conservative again about their IT spending and also who they bought from. So we had some success. We did sell to MetLife Insurance, Bank of America, and some top-tier enterprises, but it was hard going. And it was kind of frustrating in a way. As soon as we sold to IBM, many deals that we were trying to close and failing, as soon as IBM bought us, those deals closed immediately, because buying from IBM was the conservative thing to do in those days, certainly, and you know, still today. So that was a lesson. You know, we had a modest success, but it could have been a lot more if we weren't dealing with such a conservative market at that time.
How was it like to do an M&A transaction, you know, selling your business to such a big player like IBM? How was that?
Well, that was my first time going through. Well, sorry, it was my second time. But first time going through an acquisition by a big enterprise, let's say. First time with a big enterprise, and it's quite an experience. We turned up there in Albany for 2 days of due diligence, and they had given us a questionnaire in advance with well over 1,000 questions. For example, there were 35 questions on environment, whether we're polluting any rivers, you know, that kind of thing. Now, we're a software company, but they don't care. They ask all the questions. So very, very heavy process. And we had this funny thing when we met them and they, you know, we said, oh, we're a team of about 30. And they said, we're also a team of about 30. Of course, they meant just the team doing due diligence was 30. You know, IBM at that time was 300,000 people, but they'd sent 30 people just to sit with us and do due diligence. So it was a very heavy process, but ultimately successful. And the product did very well inside IBM.
So then let's talk about, what happened after. You know, obviously, one thing that is incredible is that you go from two successful outcomes to all of a sudden a fire sale. You know, and it's like, they say you either succeed or you learn. So with this next experience, what happened there that really forced you guys to having to go to really sell the business, you know, and perhaps not at the desirable outcome that you had hoped for?
Yeah, I mean, look, you win some, you lose some. I always knew that it's risky. And I was always very honest with my investors. I, even though they know that, I always said explicitly to my investors, you could lose all your money. And that was helpful. So when they did lose almost all their money, I was able to, you know, look them straight in the eye, and some of them invested with me again afterwards. So I kept a good relationship. The company then, it was called Ghost, which was kind of a clever acronym of Global Hosted Operating System. And it was my only time I did B2C, which is always even much more risky than B2B. So it was consumer web. And it turns out that we were too early to market was really the issue there, because we ended up getting... We really did something which is very similar to Dropbox and Box.net and, you know, keep all your files in the cloud. And if we were 2 years later, maybe we could have been, you know, Box or Dropbox. We had the right idea. You know, I had the right idea and we built a good product. Iterated, of course, we had issues, but we built a good product. And if we were 2 years later, it might have been a huge success. It might have been worth billions of dollars. We were too early. It's kind of hard to remember, but in 2000, the internet wasn't very fast. You know, in those days, when you bought a broadband internet connection for your home, it was 256 kilobits per second, you know, a quarter of 1 megabit. Now everyone's got 100 megabits and 500 megabits. So the internet infrastructure just wasn't ready for keep all your files in the cloud. So we had the right idea, and we were actually a couple of years too early to market, I would say.
So in this case then, you know, market timing, you know, what did you take away there from market timing that maybe some of the founders listening, you know, can really get inspired by from some of those lessons on being able to time things?
Well, you know, get it right. You know, being too late is, everyone knows that if you're too late, then it's tough. But being too early can kill you for sure just as much, maybe more. Maybe being early kills you more, because there are amazing cases of people who were late to market and succeeded. Maybe the most obvious one is Google. I remember very well when the first time someone showed me Google, and I'm like, what are they thinking? It's too late. We've got Yahoo search, we've got Ink2Me search, and you know, Alta Vista, and you know, there's several great search engines. Who would even fund a new search engine? It just seemed like ridiculous to me. They were too late to market. And boy, was I wrong. You know, they just created a search engine which was a bit quicker and a bit better, and everyone moved. So you can recover. You can be late to market. And if your product is better, you can win. If you're too early to market and you don't have enough money to wait it out, then you're dead.
So, I mean, here you are, you know, building, scaling, you know, exiting successfully and unsuccessfully also companies, learning a lot, having a lot of fun. So why going from being the founder to being more an employee?
Yes, for a couple of years I was a CEO. But although I wasn't the founder, I'd been involved in that company for a long time. My dad was an investor there. I'd been on the board of directors. I'd been involved in the original investment there. So I'd been, although I was not the founder, I'd been quite involved as an active director for many years, and certainly felt some of the same ownership that you feel when you're the founder. And at that time, we had to fire the CEO who was there, and there was a gap. So one, I wanted to help out. I cared about the company, but also, you know, it was an interesting experience. That's where I learned all about supply chain and managing inventory, and you know, managing a hardware company is really something very different. So I had a good couple of years at Lightech and had a good opportunity to sell it to GE Lighting in 2011.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out. And hey, you know, that's where the idea of your next baby came about. So which is the one that you've been pushing up for quite a bit of time. So walk us through, what was that ideation process? Because at this point you had built a couple of companies, and you really understood, you know, what it took from point A to point C. So walk us from how you come up with the idea to really testing it, validating it, and then being like, this is it, let's go.
Yeah, well, I thought I understood. I've learned some new things as well, but for sure. So, I mean, it was really a classic case where I saw the need. So when I was at Lightech, we were doing international shipping. We were manufacturing, it was electronic power supplies for LED lights is what we were doing, which was good because LED lights was a growing market. By now, it's taken over the world. But then it was quite new and growing fast. And we were manufacturing in the south of China, like most electronics, and shipping by ocean and by air from Shenzhen area to the US and to Europe, where our customers were. And so, Yeah, so we did that. And, you know, I was just kind of shocked. You know, I expected that, I mean, if you want to travel from Shenzhen to New York or Paris, already for 25 years, or at that time already for 15 years, you know, there was a website where you could see all the options and book online. So I certainly thought that when I was the first time I was shipping a container or air cargo from Shenzhen to LA, actually, or to London, I said, okay, where's the website where I can see all the prices and book, you know? And I was kind of shocked to find out that it didn't exist. Not only that there wasn't a website, but you call up the companies who arrange this are called freight forwarders. It's a big industry. As you know, Alejandro, when you go into a shop in America, in Europe, 90% of the products you buy are imported. So this is a huge part of the world economy, international shipping. A huge part of our lifestyle, a huge part of how the world economy works is international shipping. But not only was it not online, but when you call up a freight forwarder, and there's 100,000 freight forwarders in the world, it's a very, very big industry. When you call them up, that they don't pick it up when they say they're going to pick it up. They don't deliver it when they say they're going to deliver. You wait, and this is still the case. We've started to change it, but it's still common. You can wait 2 or 3 days for a price quote. When you get an invoice afterwards, it doesn't match the price quote. You know, there's hidden fees. It's a complete mess. And, you know, I felt like I was the first guy to ship something from China to the US, you know, the way they treated me. And as you know, that's something which is done hundreds of thousands of times a day. And yet it was completely unautomated, completely opaque. So yeah, you know, it was just a classic situation where I started Freightos because I saw a big gap in the market and a big need.
So how do you guys make money with Freightos? How what's the business model there?
Yeah, two main business models. One is, you know, I do see us primarily as a platform, as a marketplace or a platform which matches buyers and sellers. So part of our revenue is transactional. We call that platform revenue. And we're now a public company, so we report platform and solutions separately. So we've got platform revenue, which is transactional. But still, a majority of our revenue is actually subscriptions. So it's mostly SaaS, software as a service subscriptions, but also data subscriptions. We sell data. We have the best data in the world for what is the current price of shipping a container, what is the current price of shipping kilograms by air. And so we publish that data and other related data on the Freightos terminals. So our solutions business is, so it's basically platform, which is transactional, and then solutions, which splits into SaaS and data subscriptions.
So then in this case too, I mean, you guys have raised quite a bit of money, you know, with going public and then also with the investors prior to that. So how much in total have you guys raised to date?
$200 million in total.
And then what has been the journey of raising that money? Because obviously, too, you know, you are a successfully exited founder. So you are, according to investors, a tier zero founder that is very hard to come by. So I know that it was more than the people and the money. So how did you go about the people? You know, how did the cycle shift? How was going public? So walk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, there are some advantages when you're doing this for, like, you know, the fourth time that you do have a relationship with venture capitalists. That helped a lot because when we started Freightos, the VCs didn't really think about supply chain or logistics as an interesting area. That changed then over the years that we were, by the time we did a Series C, you know, Logtech was already sort of a thing. So VCs had discovered that here's a big industry which needs to be modernized. But I think the series, the seed and the series A, I only did because I had relationships and a track record that helped me a lot because investors were not otherwise looking at Logtech at that time. Then I did a series C, which was mainly actually strategic investors. So FedEx invested and SGX invested, the Singapore Stock Exchange invested. And then we did our final rounds by going public. We IPO'd via a SPAC in January of last year.
How crazy was that?
Well, you know, again, I have to say I went through it with my eyes open. You know, our stock has not traded well since then, which is disappointing. But I told all the team and I told all the investors, we're not doing this to exit. We're doing this to raise money. You know, and I haven't sold any shares and almost all my investors haven't sold any shares. You know, we did it as a good way to raise money. At that particular time, there was a lot of money in SPACs. We were right at the end of the whole wave of SPACs. We were one of the last SPACs to really get out. But at that time, there was a lot of money in SPACs. It was good money. It was, you know, there was good investors behind our SPAC and M&G, which is a top British funds, invested. And they're long-term investors. So actually, I think for us, it was better than an IPO because in IPO, you get a lot of people who are just investing short-term for the IPO pop. We raised $80 million from long-term investors at that time. So it was a great way to raise money from quality long-term investors. And I said to all my team, and I said to my investors, we're not doing this to exit. I hope the share trades well, but that's not what it's about. I'm not even going to look at the share price. This is a good way to raise quality money. And in that respect, it was very successful for us. Of course, I'd be happy if the share traded well and reflected our true value. That would be even better. But even though it's not, and the volume is very, very small in our share, so it's not a very liquid share yet, even so, we achieved our main goal, which is to raise good money from good investors.
So let's talk about that, because I'm sure that, you know, like, people are going to be able to really learn a lot, you know, when it comes to like the key ingredients to choosing the right investors. If you could share, what are the top three that founders should keep in mind? What should those be?
You want investors who are going to understand your business and be supportive. You want investors who are suitable to your business. So I knew when I started Freightos that this would take a long time. I'll be perfectly honest, I didn't know how long it would take. I knew it would take a good number of years. This is a big conservative industry. I knew it wouldn't change quickly. And so I took investors who were in it for the long term. And honestly, yes, it took even longer than we thought, but it's succeeding. And my investors have been very patient and never pressured me to exit early, never always understood it would take a long time. So you need the right kind of investors for the type of business that you're building. We were building a business which is modernizing, digitalizing a very large, very conservative industry. It was always clear that's going to take time, taking even longer than we thought, but succeeding. And so it's fantastic that we have investors who, some of whom are in already for more than a decade and still not pressuring me to help them exit, still supporting me making the right long-term decisions. So that's super important. You know, value add is the third, but the least important. If investors can add value, that's great. If they have connections, if they have insights, if they are able to help with the business, that's a value add, that's always good, but it's not critical. What's critical is to have investors who are going to be supportive and who are aligned with you on what kind of business you're building and what kind of timescales you're building on.
So let's say you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world, Sri, where you are able to see fully realized the vision for Freightos. What does that world look like?
Well, the vision, it's quite simple, really. The vision for Freightos is that shipping goods around the world will be transparent and automated, just like passenger travel has become. And, you know, we're already making progress towards that. And we're making more progress in air cargo than ocean. In air cargo, we did, you know, about a billion dollars of spend on air cargo, which represents, you know, many billions of dollars of goods were booked fully digitally last year. And that's we're at an even higher run rate now. So we're starting to see that. Still, it's a small proportion of the world market, but we have some scale now. So we're able to see what it looks like. And it's just what you'd expect. It's bringing the same experience for shipping of goods as we already have for passenger travel, where things are very transparent, very online. And through that, improving world trade. I think world trade is important. It's important for employment. It's important for our lifestyle. It's important for world peace, in a way. You know, there is a claim, and it's quite well backed, that when countries trade with each other, they're less likely to fight with each other. It's not a guarantee, but clearly there was a correlation between, you know, trade opening up and peace. And I know there's some parts of the world which are far from at peace, but still most of the world is at peace. And Europe, besides other than Ukraine, but Western Europe has been at peace for you know, 80 years now, for the first time in history. So even though there are some horrible exceptions, it's still true that as countries open their borders and trade with each other, it contributes to world peace.
So now let's talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. Let's say, you know, you were able to go back in time, and I'm able to put you in the spot where you are now a software engineer that is thinking about, you know, switching gears here and becoming an entrepreneur. Let's say you had the opportunity of being able to be right there with that younger self, and you're able to give that software engineer one piece of advice before launching a business, what would that be and why, given what you know now?
Goodness. I don't know. I think if I was a young entrepreneur and some guy, some dude sort of turned up from the future, started giving me advice, I wouldn't appreciate it very much. So I think I wouldn't.
Well, let's say that younger self actually listened.
Look, I don't have anything clever to say that you haven't heard before, but, and you've probably heard this many times before, but it is a lot about the team. So, you know, so surround yourself by great people, surround yourself by smart, engaged, loyal people. That's obviously, and I'm sure many other entrepreneurs you've heard given the same advice, but that's the reason why many people say that is because it's true. Likewise, treat your investors as part of the extended team. Find good investors who are going to support you, who are aligned with your vision and your timescales. And also, you know, there's a lot of luck. I don't think that when I had successes, I don't think it's because I was clever. When I had failures, I don't think it was because I'm stupid. And you've probably heard this from other entrepreneurs as well. But we have to be honest, there's a lot of luck along the way. And so you have to enjoy the ride and celebrate the wins and don't beat yourself up about the losses.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, LinkedIn or my email, svi@freightos.com.
Well, that's easy enough. Well, Svi, thank you so much for being in the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Oh, my honor. Thanks for having me on.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening and see you at the next episode.